Good morning, I am Tim and I am an alcoholic. I know I'm getting old because my favorite Christmas present was a squatty potty and a shower seat. I had to get a laugh, I had to get that out. My sobriety date is August 4th of 2017. I want to thank you guys thank Johnny for asking me to do this. I've been playing this around in my brain for about a little over a decade of when I'm going to finally tell my story, and I stuck around long enough where I finally get to do it. You know, and I appreciate it. I don't know if the dates are going to all meld up with actual facts, but you guys are never going to know the difference. The important thing is that I'm here. I'm no better than anybody else. I'm no worse than anybody else. You've heard this story before. You know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm a father. I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm an uncle. I'm an employee. I am. I'm a person. I'm an alcoholic is what I am. And I'm glad I found these rooms. It's important that I be honest with you guys because honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness is something that I evaded for so very long. So I apologize if there's any young ears in the room. Sometimes I do get a little bit crass with my words, but we're going to go forward. I come from a pretty standard family. I'm Irish Catholic, raised. I was born in New York. Outside of Queens, in a town called Mineola. My father was a Marine. My mom was always a stay-at-home mom. They got married pretty young. My dad was, I think, 26, but my mom was, like, right at 20. And she had my older brother, Charlie, right around then. He's my older brother by 3 years. I have a younger brother, Bill. He's my younger brother by about 2.5 years. We'll get more to Bill's story here in a little bit. And I have a younger sister who was born in 1980, so whatever that makes her, 30, 38, almost 39. Alcohol was always like a big part of my life growing up. Like I said, I grew up Irish Catholic in the Northeast. It was like events had to do with alcohol, no matter what. Like, I remember taking sips of wine, taking sips of champagne, taking sips of beer at like 5, 6, and 7. You know, it was just a part of everything. It was magical. You know, it was, as seeing it as a young person and seeing what the adults were doing, I just looked at him going, wow, that looks really, really cool. You know, that's something that's magic. It makes them funny. It makes them laugh. It was just always magical to me. And it wasn't really anything I was going to get into until I got to like grade school. You know, when things started to feel different for me, I didn't really fit in. You know, we heard this before too. I look at pictures looking back when I'm growing up, and like every picture I'm like, there's like a group of people and then I'm like standing over here to the side. You know, I just don't know why I didn't fit in. I had normal friends. I played soccer growing up. I did a lot of skiing growing up. Skied up in Lake Placid, New York, where they had the Olympics. So I got a lot of good experience, training with the Olympians and playing hockey and all that kind of stuff. It was kind of neat. But I kind of wanted to get away, but I didn't know how. I'm getting ahead of myself. In sixth grade, I remember a girl. We had before school started when I was growing up. We had the Labor Day fair. It was like a big end of summer, and it was a fair, and it was really magical. Everybody got all dressed up because they had everything they did during the summer. They would show up before we went back to school, and the Labor Day fair was at the park, and we'd get up at the park and play the games, ride the rides. Well, one time, I think this was sixth grade, a girl had a six pack of warm Miller Genuine Draft. And she's like, she had kept it. She's like, I've been saving this all summer for the fair. And it was all warm. She kept it in her top drawer, and we snuck away from the fair and went and got it and brought it back and drank it in the woods. And I was like, whoa. I think I probably had a whole beer. And keep in mind, up until even my college year, I didn't weigh like a buck five. I was like 105 pounds. And I drank that beer, and that sense of ease and comfort came. And man, like I had had sips, and I saw the magic that happened. And then I had that beer by myself, and I was like, wow, this is why they do it. This is why they do it, man. And that put a little seed in my brain that grew a little bit. And then that was sixth grade. And then eighth grade, you know, we're getting ready for going into high school, and I had my best friend sleeping over. My parents were away, and they had the old-fashioned 1970s liquor cabinet that had all the big fancy bottles in it. And man, we got into that. And I'll never forget. We were eating Chinese food, and we had just gotten like brand new couches and new rugs in the den, and my parents were away again. So we chowing down on Chinese food, and then we went to the liquor bar and started drinking that. And we had a pool out back, and we were slapping each other in the face and going in the pool and not feeling anything. Everything was great. And we get back inside, and we're like all warm, and we had crossed that edge. You know, we had crossed over into where it was making us sick. And Matt was the first to get sick, and I remember he woke up and he threw up an entire celery stalk. I swear to God, it's like he got up and started running to the bathroom, and a celery stalk came out on the brand new couch, and then rice all the way down the hallway. And that was like the first time I got in trouble because my grandma was there, Mimi, sweet little Mimi. She wakes up and what the hell's going on down there? We had ruined the brand new furniture, and that was the first time I got in trouble getting drunk. Also in grade school, this is part of my story. I didn't really share it with anybody until I shared it with my dad when I was going to my first rehab. But in sixth grade, and then I was going to say it quick. I had a teacher who violated me in sixth grade, and like. It was just like, I don't know, I was trying to fit in again, and my grade school teacher paid me attention, and he told me to wear sweatpants all to school all the time, and then he'd stay after class, and he'd do these things that aren't right to do to a child, and I didn't know it was wrong, you know. And then these weird things with adults happen like that for me, you know. I got to high school, and there was a teacher there who, like, similar things, you know. Jeez, this is weird. Similar things, and at that point, I'm like, I knew better. I knew better than like, hey, you're in high school. Why is this happening to you? This isn't fair. But those are things that just made me stick out more. And then I retreated. I retreated away from everything. I didn't have any friends. And then I started like. Stealing stuff because it made me feel better. You know, I could control these things. So I terrorized our neighborhood for a good year and a half to 2 years. I ran around our neighborhood stealing hood ornaments from expensive cars. You know, that was the time when rappers were cool and they were wearing their emblems around their necks, and I would steal these things and then I would sell them and people would buy them. You know, I got kind of caught up with another crowd who found out I was doing it. They wanted to be part of it. Well, one of the kids who was doing it with me was a son of a court clerk, and he got caught. And so when he got caught, he snitched on all, you know, on all the whole thing, and I got in trouble with the law. And I had to do that summer. I had to do 100 hours of community service. I had to write a 5,000 word essay on what a good citizen is. So you know, I'm doing things to isolate, and then I get in trouble for them. And I'm starting to have some consequences, and my fears of everything are building up. Also in high school, a good friend of mine was in a car accident and died. I had never known anybody that died before, and we were in art class together, he was just driving too fast, I guess, with people, and he died, and I didn't know how to handle death. I'd never seen death in my family to that point. I didn't understand it, and all I knew is I was afraid of it. It scared me. And then a little bit later, I was in high school. This is now like senior year of high school. I'm funneling beer at this point every other day. You know, building funnels and funneling beer every day after school at Chris Gates' house. We build a funnel because we're going to have a party at Mike Gill's house. And I'm using last names. These people are passed away now. Mike Gill was a really good friend, well, really good friend of mine. We isolated and played video games together, but he had a party, and everybody was drinking. We were playing poker up in the attic, and people were smoking up there, throwing their cigarettes into trash cans, and we had grand plans. Yeah, we're all gonna sleep over here. We're all gonna get really messed up. We're gonna have an awesome time. Well, I'm like, I'm not sleeping here. I got to go tell my parents that what I'm doing. We didn't have cell phones back then. So I got my car, drove back to my parents' house. It was about 4 miles away, and went and got my stuff, told my parents, hey, I'm leaving. And as I was walking out, my older brother was walking in, and he goes, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going back to this party. And he goes, no, you're not. I go, yeah, I am. He goes, no. He goes, it's 12:15. There's nothing good that can happen now. He goes, go back inside. And I thank God he did that. Because those kids who were playing poker upstairs and flicking their cigarettes into the trash cans, the curtains caught fire. And that house burned to the ground. And Mike died. But like my friends thought it was me because I told everybody I was going back. And so I was out that next morning driving in the car with my parents and we were out driving for like 3 or 4 hours. And I got back and the home phone, back then we had answering machines, had like 20 messages on it. And it was all my friends calling, Tim. They couldn't identify the body that was in that house and people thought it was me or Mike. And later they found out it was Mike. And that was just, wow. If my brother didn't stop me from going back and drinking at that house, that could have been, that could have been me. So again, fear of death coming back. Also during high school, although I was isolating, I did find a girlfriend, my very first like real girlfriend, and come to find out years later she's in this program. But at that point, I learned codependency and isolation with women, and became real good at that throughout my life. But I had her as my girlfriend for 3 years of high school. And she was my first girl who I learned about the birds and the bees with her, and I thought I was never going to let her go because my dad's a Marine and Semper Fi says forever loyal, and I was going to marry that girl. I just knew it, and I was in love with her. But she had some issues, and she ended up pulling a knife on me. And when she was apparently she told me at this point that she was drunk, but she pulled a knife on me, and the police were called, and had to move on from her. So after high school, I went to undergrad school at Clemson University in South Carolina. I moved down there when I was 17, got early enrolled. I guess I'm pretty book smart because I like to learn. I like to go to school. I like to take classes. I took enough credits to have like 4 different degrees, but I didn't focus myself, so I really only ended up with 3. I had a double major in finance and accounting and organizational behavior, which I guess is kind of like operations management. I love Clemson, man. I still bleed orange, and I think that's pretty much where my growing up stopped. 17 years old down at Clemson University, my maturity halted. Dead stop. And that's kind of where I was still at up until about a year and a half ago and starting to learn things. But yeah, Clemson, I was part of the crew team. I think because I missed something here, but I was part of the crew team where I used to play soccer all this. It was grown in high school, but I busted my knee real bad a couple times. So I had a scholarship to Clemson and they took that away when I busted my knee. So I was on the crew team on the rowing team. And that was like a fraternity. It was a band of brothers there, man. And we were the redneck rowers. You know, nobody ever heard a crew back in South Carolina rowing on Lake Hartwell until we started doing it. And we were actually pretty good. And we had some old equipment and we put together this team. We started the team. We actually sunk the docks and built the boathouse and got donations and got really good, got better equipment. And we started competing and winning. And we went to Philadelphia and won. We went to Boston and won. And we were beating the Ivy Leagues. And we were wearing life beaters, the shirts. And they were wearing their Henleys. And they're like, who are these guys? And it was awesome, man. And that was my high point socially. Socially, I fit in, kind of. I mean, it was a group of people who we worked real hard and we played real hard. And when we played real hard, we drank. We drank like. They called them regattas, but when we had a regatta, we wouldn't drink for like a day and a half before. But then afterwards it was on. And to this day, I still have some good friends in the crew team, but that's kind of where my halting and the halting of my development, I think, emotionally stopped is at 17, 18, 19 years old. So I finished college. While I was in college, I guess this is important. I met my wife. So she was kind of hanging around the crew team, and I met her at a rope swing in Walhalla, South Carolina. We were drinking beers, and I thought that was always romantic. I mean, it was a romantic way to meet my girl at a rope swing in the backwoods of South Carolina. And we got married in 1996. I was 22 years. I just turned 22 years old. And I ruined that. I ruined my marriage. You know, well, I'm going to get into this story a little bit more, but she was a great woman. We got married. So in 1996, I graduated college. I got married. I bought a house in Kennesaw, Georgia. Got a dog, did the whole thing, man. I was doing the deal. I was growing up, and I was showing my parents that I could be an adult like everybody else, and I had all the things. So I moved to Atlanta and started working for the railroad in their accounting department. And I remember this guy who used to work for me, and I moved down to Atlanta like 6 months before my wife could move down. She was doing stuff with getting her teaching certificate or something. So I lived here for about 6 months before, and I started drinking like every day, which is weird for me. At that point, I wasn't drinking every day. I was just drinking, partying, you know, like at Clemson. But then when I moved and was living by myself in an apartment, I was drinking a six pack. At that point, was a lot for me. And I come in the morning feeling a little bit crappy. And the guy who sat in the cube next to me is like, "Tim, you smell like beer." And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Well, how many beers did you drink last night?" And we were both young. He's like, "Six beers." He's like, "Damn, six beers." He goes, "Who goes home and drinks five Cokes or six Cokes, and you're drinking, why do you do that?" "I don't know, Johnny. I don't know why. I don't know why I drink that." But that's kind of where I started getting that again, isolation all by myself. So I worked at the railroad for 2 years. Things are going good at the house. You know, we're still young in marriage. My wife becomes pregnant, in 1999, while she's pregnant, I go to grad school at Georgia Tech because Norfolk Southern, I can do better. I can do better than that. The grass is always greener. So grad school, I meet a couple guys who we hang out with and do the grad school thing. It's a lot of group work, and they belonged in these rooms too, and we started drinking before class, you know, and then it was. By the second year, we were drinking in class. You know, I would be drinking, and this is at Clemson too. So I'd be drinking, and I'd go to classes that I wasn't even signed up for. I was taking final exams for things I wasn't even signed up for. And same thing at Georgia Tech. I would go in and just to be around people who were doing the right thing and learning, and I was just drinking because I was punishing myself. I punished myself because I don't even know why yet. You know, I don't know why, if it's something that goes back to things that happened with my teachers or what, but I punished myself. And then finished grad school. My son was born on October 5th of 2000. He was born on my birthday. And the greatest gift of my life. The greatest gift of my life is my kids, and he's my first one. So fast forward, that was October 5th, 2000, and then September 11th, 2001 happened, and I was at home, and my father, who worked on Wall Street his entire life, was in the building when the planes hit. So he was there when the planes hit, and I was at my job doing payroll. I remember it because we used to be able to pull the radio up on my phone, and I was listening to the phone while I'm doing payroll, and at 9:07, you know, the first plane hit, and it was like, "What? What the heck's going on?" I didn't really believe anything was going on. I didn't even put together, like, "My dad's there. What's going on?" I tried to call him. At that point, we had cell phones running pretty good. No phones went through. Then the second plane hit, and I'm just like, "I gotta go home. I gotta watch this on TV." And I went home, and my wife was at home, and my son was there. He was just now starting to walk and stuff. And I watched that stuff on the TV, and I couldn't take it. I couldn't get a hold of my dad. I didn't know what was going on. The tower fell. I'm like, "Oh, what is going on in this country?" And I started drinking to cover it up. And my wife was there, but she didn't know I'd opened like one of those big bottles of red wine. And, And so I hit that, and she told me after I opened up, she's like, I gotta go. And she left the house for some reason, but left me in charge of my son who's 1 year old, and I'm drinking. And I finished that bottle of wine, and my body couldn't take it, and I passed out, like hardcore passed out. The next thing I remember, my neighbor is at the door, my wife's back from wherever she went, the police are there. My son had wandered out my back door while I passed out on the floor. And he walked down, and thank God my neighbor was out in his yard and found my son. And I went to the hospital that day. They rubbed my chest and stuff to get me back to breathing or whatever. And that was where I knew I'm not right. I'm an alcoholic. This doesn't happen to normal people at all. And you know, what that did too to my wife was like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? Who did I just attach myself to, and now I have a kid with him? And man, the shame and guilt that came from that, man. Ooh, yeah. You know, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for me. The following month, I believe it was the following month, my older brother got married in the Philippines. So my son's brand new. He couldn't make the trip. It's like a 20-hour flight or whatever. So I went over to the Philippines. Again, big family event. Everybody's there. And spare no expense. So there was booze all the time. A couple things I remember from that wedding. Number one, I remember being challenged by saying that you're too little, you can't fight. And I'm like, I played hockey for 15 years, I can fight. And I ended up the one of the groomsmen, I pulled the shirt over his head and crossed with my elbow and broke his nose the night before the wedding. And it's like, who does that? Who does that one? You know, and then I also remember my brother tackling me and we rolling down a flight of stairs and I broke my ribs. You know, I woke up in the pitch black, like the darkest I've ever been in. It's like a cave. There's no light, and I was sitting, and it smelled like shit. And I'm like, I didn't know where I was or what was going on. I kind of just like sat and just did one of these things to see if I could feel anything around me, and I couldn't. And like, what's going on? So I stood up and I felt something here, and it was a shower curtain. I'm like, okay, I'm in a bathroom. And finally reached around, turned on the light. At some point during that night, I guess I thought that the tub was a toilet, and I had gone in there and closed the door and sat down and defecated in the bathroom of the hotel room and woke up in that haze. And I'm like, embarrassing my family again, you know, embarrassing my family again. So at my job, I got back from the Philippines. I made it back. They lost my luggage, but I made it back. And I was working my job. My first job out of grad school was with a company that supplied uniforms and floor mats. And, they had a route. It was a route-based business. And the guys who ran the routes reported to me. And, so part of my job was to run on routes with them, make sure they're doing their job. Well, I started running my own routes. You know, I started, getting there early and drinking a 40-ounce ice house beer before I got in the truck with them. And that started my route running career. And I did that a lot. And that's when I started drinking and driving by myself a lot. And I would do started off with beers, and I'd do the sky hook over the thing. And I had this one dump site where I was like, this is actually getting cool. I'm putting so many bottles there. It's actually piling up with a big brown pile, and you know, just doing it. No consequences for drinking and driving at that point. I got promoted, and I kept getting promoted. You know, I don't know, even though I was drinking and still crazy in the head, I kept doing good at work, or people kept thinking I was doing good at work, and I kept getting promoted. I got promoted to a general manager position with this company. I was the youngest in this Fortune 500 company. I was their youngest general manager ever. They moved me to South Carolina, up to Spartanburg. And that's when my daughter was born. My daughter was born in 2003. And Anna Jane, I never thought I had the capacity for love like that, until I saw my daughter. Blonde hair, blue eyes, and, wow. Wow. So, I'm gonna skip through some stuff, and I don't know where I'm going with all this stuff. Like I said, I'm gonna forget stuff, but you're not gonna know it. So life's going all right as far as the job goes. The drinking's still kind of pretty heavy, you know, not heavy, but kind of heavy. And then I get a job where I was recruited away from this company, and I was recruited by the guy who owns the Dolphins, the Marlins, and the Panthers, the hockey team. He started Blockbuster, Viacom, AutoNation. And I was going to work for this guy. And man, was I like loving it, man. I'm going to be a hot shot. So I went around the country for this guy buying franchises and then turning them into company stores so we could bring them up as a company and then sell the whole company. And that summer I traveled the whole United States, went to ball games in every MLB park in the country, man. I was loving it. But I had an expense card, so I had an expense card, and they didn't care, man. I was taking people out, I was wine and dining, but mainly I was wine and dining myself. I was eating steak and drinking a lot. You know, I would rent cars and return rental cars with empty beer cans and stuff in them. I mean, I was a terror around the country. I'd fly into Buffalo and end up in Minneapolis, and I stayed for like a week in LA. Like, I had free reign of this credit card, and I was flying and still doing my job, still being successful. But my wife's at home. You know, I got a wife and two kids now at home, and I didn't even know it. How does someone stick with me? Why? You're never home. I feel like I'm doing this by myself, Tim. No, you're not. Damn it. I'm doing this for you. No, I wasn't. This was all selfish, man. So my wife's like, man, you gotta do something. You gotta get a job local. So I quit that job to be more present and, moved from Spartanburg to Greensboro, North Carolina, with another uniform company. And I was this way it was more regional. So I had North Carolina and South Carolina at this point. And it was with this company where I got a company car and, we were doing a presentation out in San Francisco, I guess. In San Francisco, I mean, I hate flying, without being drunk. So, we were at a sales presentation in San Fran and I was going to fly home. So I got drunk. I got pretty lit up in the San Francisco airport and I drank somewhere over the Colorado Rockies on the way back and flew into Charlotte and driving from Charlotte to Greensboro. I got pulled over by the state patrol. And man, I thought I was above that. I thought I was never going to get a DUI. And that day I sat in the car and, the guy who pulled me over looked almost exactly like you, Raymond. He was a big, big dude, black dude and scary, man. He was a scary guy. Yeah. No, I didn't know they did this. He took me out of my car and put me in his front seat. And he turned to me, he goes, how much have you had to drink? I'm like, I haven't had anything to drink. I just got in from San Francisco. He goes, how much have you had to drink? And I'm like, I literally didn't know. So he made me blow. And at that point, the legal limit in North Carolina was 0.10, or it just changed from 0.10 to 0.08. And I think I blew like a 0.09 or right on the border. But anyway, I went to jail. I got Charlotte Mecklenburg's finest outfit. And that was scary, man. That was scary being in jail. And they give you a toothbrush about this big, so you don't stab people with it. And, your sink is the same thing as your toilet. And I'm like, what am I doing now? I'm a guy who goes to grad school and makes money. And I have a stay at home wife and two kids. And now I'm in Charlotte Mecklenburg lockup with a window this big. So my first inclination was like, okay, what am I going to do? I called some people that I knew to see if they could bail me out. Nobody answered the phone. Called, definitely not calling my wife. God damn it. What if she finds out I'm in jail? I'm 2 hours away and in jail. I called my dad and this was 2 o'clock in the morning. And, I'm like, Dad, I need you to bail me out. He goes, are you fucking kidding me? God, he goes, you're a nut. He always called me this name, Numb Nuts. You know, I knocked down a snow pile when he was shoveling snow and he called me Numb Nuts when I was five and I always remember it, but they ain't Numb Nuts. But, so he bailed me out and, I got out and as I was driving from Charlotte back to Greensboro, I called my older brother. I'm like, Charlie, what do I do? And he's like, don't tell anybody. Bury that down. And that's like the nature of like anything that I've ever been taught is like, your teacher touches you, bury it down. You get a DUI, bury it down. Just bury it down. Don't let it out. That's shame. That's guilt. Keep it for yourself. I got a DUI in that company car. So yeah, they took that company car away and I lost that job. That was the first time I really got fired from a job. and didn't really feel good about it. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I'm starting to get too much into this this stuff. But made a decision to make a job change in 2007, between 2007-2008, the great financial crash that we all know and love. I decided to get into financial management. What? This is actually before it happened. So things come easy to me. So I took my Series 7, took my Series 66, got my life, my health, my long-term care licenses, and worked for Merrill Lynch. 3 months later, Merrill Lynch was bought by Bank of America, and then Bank of America fired everybody at Merrill Lynch. So got all my certifications, and then Merrill Lynch kind of downsized me, I guess. Bank of America did it. So I went and worked for a company called Edward Jones, where they operate. It's kind of like a man in his own store. So I had a small outfit that I was running down there by myself, and again, free reign to drink and do as my own. I didn't have to answer to anybody, and I didn't like all the freedom. So I tried to give myself some accountability. So I got a job with BB&T Bank, and at BB&T Bank, it was a great opportunity, man. And we had customers. I didn't have to go out and prospect. Customers came into me. They were wanting me to tell them what to do with their money. And in my coffee cup, I got some vodka in it. Just beware when you're interviewing your financial advisors. Jim, come on, man. Make sure you check the coffee cup. So BB&T, I had a boss there. His name was Paige. And, I don't know if he was one of us or not, but he sure did act like it, man. He was patient and he was tolerant. And he was loving, and I think he saw that I was struggling, man. He took me one day, because as I drink, I balloon up, so I had gotten kind of big. And he took me. He's like, man, we need to go get you a suit. The man took me to the men's warehouse and bought me a couple suits. And he said, Tim, I'm just gonna ask you, are you all right? Are you all right? No, no, man. Nobody had ever asked me that. No one had ever asked me that before. Are you all right? You. And that's when I went to my first rehab, man. That was voluntary. With him, and he made it happen where BB&T, I'd worked for them for like 3.5 months. They made that available to me. I didn't have to pay a dime. So I went to my first rehab, and I lasted, that was like a 28 day program. And I had the support, at least I thought, the full support of my wife and my family and her family. And I got out and I made it 60 days without drinking. Woo. And my marriage at that point, that was in 2008, you know, my wife ended up finding out about my DUI. I have to tell that. But, so after that, my marriage and my health and my faith are failing. Nothing's working. I'm getting so sick, like when I don't drink, and just kind of, I don't want to really talk about the volumes of my drinking, but it's astounding that my body can take what I did. And I was drinking Mad Dog 2020. I was drinking Johnny Bootleggers. I was drinking vodka. You know, someone said that they mix their vodka with their wine. I mean, I did the same thing. I would drink so much. Like it amazes me, you know, but my body couldn't take it, and so I was having like uncontrollable diarrhea, and I was having throw-ups and dry heaves, and it was horrible. So I went to two detoxes and then two more rehabs, and at that point I was not covered by insurance for rehab, so they were like state-run, and state-run rehabs are a blessing, but they're also real scary, man. Depends where you're at. And I've been to a couple scary ones. And that was in High Point, North Carolina. Trying to fast forward here. So I got out of my very last, the last rehab while I was married. I got out of it, and my mom came to visit after I gotten out. And when my mom comes to visit, her show of love is that she buys me groceries. And we went to the store and got groceries, and she bought all my toiletries, including Listerine. And my wife caught me drinking Listerine after I got out of rehab. What am I doing drinking Listerine, you know? That's the depths that I sunk to at that point. And she's like, you know what, man? I stuck with you. I am done. I'm like, no, you're not done. I didn't believe. I'm a loyal guy. I'm never going to leave you. You can't leave me. We made an oath on that altar. We said to love and honor and cherish forever until death do us part and through sickness and health. And she's like, no. So I didn't believe it. And then I went on I was at some business trip and I got back and it was like 11:30 at night and I pulled in my house and the locks on the doors had been changed. And I'm like, what the hell? And then my in-laws' cars are there. I'm like, what is going on? And I didn't know what was going on because I had already had a couple cocktails, you know, driving home at night. And so I try the front door. The front door's locked. I walk around the side door's locked. I'm like, what the fuck? Walk around to the basement. The basement door opens. And I walk in the basement door, and I had finished it as a photography studio for my wife. And my in-laws are in the in-law suite sleeping in there, and their dog wakes up and barks at me. And I go, Tim, what are you doing here? He goes, I thought I changed those locks. I go, no, you didn't. And I walked upstairs, walked up two flights of stairs up to my wife, and she goes, we're done. I go, no, we're not done. And she called the police, and the police came, and my kids are up crying, the dog's barking, and the police are like, you just better go. You just better go. And I didn't know what to do, so I left. Biggest mistake of my life, leaving that house, and that's pretty much how my divorce went through, man. There's a lot of resentments in there that I can't get into now. But I can tell you one thing, that her parents and her planned and executed a escape plan from me that was flawless, man. They did a really good job. They went through everything and had everything done. I didn't know it was happening until it was already gone and done. So we're divorced, and me without my kids, we had some visitations. We didn't ever have anything finalized as far as child support, and I was in and out of jobs again. I didn't know what to do, so I left and went to my parents' house. We lost the house that we had when she left. I'm like, you know, fuck this, go forth foreclosure, and they took that house, and I went to my parents. That was November of 2011, and I stayed there till January of 2012. And I just drank. I just drank around the clock. I slept for 23 hours at a time. My dad would come in and like poke me to see if I was still alive. That was the sickest I've ever been. Sickest I've ever been. Waking up, not eating. I dropped my weight, got down to 152 pounds. Nothing fit. I was sick. I was dying. I was literally dying. When I start to think about the pain that keeps me coming back here, it was that time at my parents' house. So then I decided I could come back to Atlanta and make a go of it again. I moved back into the very same apartment that I lived in when I moved down from Clemson. Very same one. Not a good idea. I drank and I had jobs. I drank them away and all that stuff. So what? I don't leave places. I run. I run and hide because I'm afraid. But anyway, somewhere in there, I met my current girlfriend. Cause I can't be alone. Damn it, man. I can't be alone. And what else should I do is take another hostage. And I met Courtney, around my birthday time of 2012. And she has been a patient woman, and she's also a drug and alcohol nurse. So I found the right one. You know, it's like I'm selfish. How selfish can I be? I'm going to find a drug and alcohol nurse, and then you're going to make me better. I gotta skip over some of this stuff. So she saw me through. So a couple more rehabs, a couple more. She got me sober a couple more times, and then I started wandering into these rooms all throughout this time, all throughout this story that I am going long. Jim, you're right. But I found these rooms and I found the Howe place, and I came and sat in that seat right there, and put my head down in my hands and cried, you know, for a long time. And I listened to stories, and I just kept coming back. I still didn't really own up to it. And I went out a couple more times and picked up white chips. And I'm definitely not a one chip wonder. You can probably tell. But then I came in June. In June, I had by that time I had gotten the job that I'm currently in right now. Back in 2016, with a great company. I didn't want to blow this one. I didn't have anything else left. My kids at this point don't see me, don't talk to me, don't care about me. I would cry if I started talking about them, so that's not going to happen. And I don't want to lose that job and the guy who I work for. So I'm like, I'm going to make a go of it this time. In June, I tell my boss I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink anymore. If you see me drink, don't. I just want to let you know that I have these problems. And I went out and bought a bright orange car because I didn't want to be caught. giving myself accountability. Accountability was forced on me by my sponsor, who told me that I was going to be secretary of the Breakfast Club. So I'm getting more things going on here. And man, what a difference it makes. What a difference it makes when I'm not dipping my toes in the pool and I jumped in and I got in the middle of it and I start doing things that are uncomfortable. I did the 90 and 90. For me, the pain to remain the same had become greater than the pain to change. And I started doing the things that people do. Listening to my sponsor, coming to meetings even when I don't want to. What it's like now, it's easier. It's slower. My brain still goes about 1,000 miles an hour, but it's different. I can pause. I can push pause. I look for the similarities, not the differences now. I hear my stories. God talks to me every single day through the people who sit in these seats. Whenever I try to talk, and I don't think I did a very good job today, but I try to talk as if I'm talking directly to a newcomer, because the newcomer is the most important person for me, and I'm selfish, and that person who's here and for the first time needs to know that it can get better. It will get better. Trust this process, because it is so much more difficult the other way. Someone who used to come in here, I forget their name, but they were in a wheelchair, and he was an older guy, and he used to tell, every single meeting, he'd just raise his hand really slowly, and he would say, "Never underestimate the absolute unimportance of practically everything." Whew, thank you, man. Thanks for telling me that, because that slowed this down. That slowed this down up here where I could say, you know what? I just don't have to drink, and I just need to come to meetings, and everything's going to be okay. So what do I do today? My sponsor ran me through the steps, and I'd been through them a couple times, but nothing like this, where it was gentle, it was soft, and it was on my terms, kind of, but not kind of. He told me to call him every single day. I called him once a week, maybe. But it was again, I had the accountability, because he's like, you know what, fine, don't call me. You're going to be secretary. My emotions are above my intellect, and my feelings are not facts. My disease tells me that I don't have a disease, and that someday, somehow, I will drink again. And I still have that in my brain that I'm going to be on a beach somewhere drinking a cocktail, with my kids and grandkids and all that, looking at me with adoration and all that kind of stuff, because I'm sick. I know that that's not going to happen, but I'm still going to hold it out there and tell myself it's going to happen. Someday that will happen, but today I'm not going to drink. So that's kind of where I'm at with my brain. I pray all the time, man. There's a higher power who I know is with me. I know he's with me every single day, because the things that happen in my life could not happen on my own. It's amazing the things that happen. And I meditate. How about that one? When you slow things down, it's amazing. It's amazing. And the St. Francis prayer while I'm doing that. And the two things I hold on is, where there is despair, I will give hope, and where there is doubt, I will show that there can be faith. Those things stick out in my brain. I've walked through a lot of pain. I kind of skipped through some stuff, and this did go faster than I thought, but I'm dealing this firsthand with my younger brother, who's dying of this disease as we speak. He's been diagnosed. He's 42 years of age. He's been diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. He's lost close to 80 pounds in the last 3.5 weeks, and I went to see him, a month and a half ago, and this is before his diagnosis, he looked all right, and then I went to go see him this past weekend, and I almost fainted on the floor. My younger brother's gonna die of this disease. And so I can't shout from the rooftops how important it is that if you think that this is a joke, it's not a joke at all. Get with a sponsor. Get into these rooms. Get to these rooms, because meeting makers make it. Come when you don't want to come. How many days did you drink? Come that times 50, and keep coming to these rooms, keep listening to these people, keep listening to these stories, because these stories are your story. Nothing great can be accomplished without enthusiasm, and if you attack this program with enthusiasm, the enthusiasm that you need to live life a better way, that's the only thing you can do. And Jimmy Valvano said, you can't give up, don't ever, ever, ever give up. I'm not special, I just listened to what some people said, and let me tell you, it does work. When we pass the baskets here in a little bit, every single day I look at my dollar bill, and it could be a penny, it could be a dollar bill, it could be a $2 bill, Kevin. E pluribus unum. Many from one. This is what we are. We come together as many, and in God we trust. Three things I know I've learned you know, coming to these meetings, that I will never be perfect. Alcoholism will never stop surprising me in its gifts and in its things that has taken from me. And staying sober will always be a community event. I appreciate this. Thank you.